Now past 11. Good morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota State Capitol. Last night, Governor Jesse Ventura, flanked by Republican House Speaker Steve Swigum and DFL Senate President Alan Speer, went before a joint House-Senate committee to lay out the case for changing the basic structure of Minnesota state government. But lots of other top officials also turned out last night to argue against moving to a one-house legislature. If the issue does end up on the ballot this fall, and if voters approve the change, the move to
it. Ventura says the current bicameral system is cumbersome and confusing. He says citizens who might otherwise participate in government are turned away by the complexities of navigating two houses.
My support for a single-house legislature is grounded in the belief that government should be accountable, responsive, and limited. The legislative process doesn't need to be complicated to be effective. Rather, it should be simple, straightforward, and understandable.
Ventura spoke in support of legislation authored by Speaker of the House Steve Swigum, a Republican, and Senate President Alan Speer, a DFLer. The proposal would create a 135-member body called the legislature. Individual members, called senators, would serve four-year staggered terms. If the bill passes and voters ratify it, the new one-house body would convene its first session in 2003. Speer says supporting the proposal shouldn't be interpreted as an attack on the current system.
I've been in the state senate for 28 years. I love this institution. I think we have one of the best legislatures in the country. So to want to improve the legislative process, to look for ways to make it more efficient, does not mean that I think that this is a broken down process.
Support for the bill crosses all political boundaries, party affiliation, legislative experience, and geography, just to name a few. On the other hand, the opposition is equally diverse. Officials from the state Republican and the DFL parties both testified against the plan, and labor lined up alongside business leaders to do the same. Bill Blazer is a vice president with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. He says eliminating one legislative body could create more government intrusion.
We concluded that a unicameral system might not mean less government because it would lower the hurdle over which an idea had to pass before it became law. In our judgment, we want to keep that hurdle about where it is today.
Blazer and other unicameral opponents say flaws in the current system could be fixed with simple changes in procedure, changes that don't require dismantling the two-house system. But Ventura says lawmakers and capital insiders have a vested interest in the status quo. He says at a bare minimum, lawmakers should put the question on the ballot next November and let Minnesota voters decide.
If you're a bicameral supporter, if it's indeed the best system, why not have the courage? You'll have the courage and confidence to believe that the Minnesotans will choose that system. If not, then again, the Minnesotans deserve the right to choose what their government will be.
However, critics of unicameralism say legislators can't place every proposed constitutional amendment on the ballot. Ash is the president of the watchdog group Common Cause of Minnesota. He says his organization opposes a one-house system, and he says he doesn't see any need to put the question on the ballot, particularly when he says there is no obvious groundswell in favor of unicameralism.
There appears to be no broad public desire for this change. The threshold you are being asked to set is too low. Based on current polling, it would seem that legalization of the medical use of marijuana surely must be moving to the ballot, as should mandatory rebates of excess state government tax collections. The numbers on probably both of those are higher.
Lawmakers took no action on the unicameralism bill, but the legislation is expected to face its first vote in the House Government Operations Committee later this week or early next week. Possible Senate action remains uncertain. The bill is expected to face a more difficult path in the latter body, where the DFL leadership is strongly opposed. At the Capitol, I'm Michael Koo, Minnesota Public Radio.
Well, joining us now here in the studio to talk some more about whether Minnesota should adopt a bicameral legislative system is former Minnesota Governor Wendell Anderson. He is on the steering committee of a group called OUCH, Opponents of a Unicameral House. Also with us is former State Senator Gene Merriam, co-chair of the Citizens Committee for a Single House Legislature. And we also invite you to join our conversation. Give us a call here. We're talking about unicameralism, whether it's a good idea or not for Minnesota. 651-227-6000. That's our Twin City area number, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Governor Anderson, Senator Merriam, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Thank you, Gary.
Now, we have a whole list of things that I want to talk about specifically, but Senator Merriam, let me start with you. If you had to pick out one major reason why we ought to change what seems to have worked well for well over 100 years, why do you think we should move to this one-house system?
Well, in a nutshell, the major reason for moving to a one-house system is to eliminate the conference committee.
Mm-hmm.
I find it interesting, and I believed when I went to the legislature 25 years ago, let me say, first of all, that it's a real treat to be on the show with former Governor Anderson, who was the governor when I came to the legislature 25 years ago, and something of an idol, who became something of a mentor, and I'm just surprised he's so misguided on this issue. I had learned the reasons why we had a bicameral system, and I thought it made sense from what my academic training taught me, that the bicameral system, when you had two houses considering the same issues, assured that you'd have due deliberation of all of those issues, and it would preclude hasty action or precipitative action on the part of the legislature. But what I saw and experienced led me to different conclusion. The conference committees, at the end of a session, assures that legislators don't have the time or the ability to find out what's in those bills, let alone to debate, discuss, and they're prohibited from amending it. So while there is careful deliberation for much of the first few months of a legislative session, I don't understand how anybody that's experienced the last 3 weeks of a legislative session and watched those conference committees in action conclude that it's a rational way to formulate public policy.
Governor Anderson, why not make this change? On the face of it, it does seem to be an attractive alternative to we've had. It would eliminate the conference committee that disturbs Senator Merriam and others so much.
Well, first, I don't think you want a legislative process that's effective, efficient, economic. It's a kind of a messy system. That's democracy. At the legislature, you're resolving really tough economic issues. Money is being appropriated. You're funding public education. It's very, very difficult. Tough issues there. Again, the burden is on the proponents to show us why we change our system, and most of the proponents, including Professor Speer, who served there for 28 years, tells us it's a very, very good system. It's not a broken-down system. But I oppose it for the following reason. First of all, I have actually served in both the House and the Senate. I think I'm the only person in the 20th century to have served in both houses and as governor. I don't know about the 19th century. You have to ask somebody even older than I. So I think I bring a unique view to it. And I must tell you, when I was in the State House of Representatives and I was in the majority, the House would often pass a bill that I thought was not in the state's interest, and I thank God there was a state Senate to kill the bill. When I was in the state Senate, I was in the minority, and the Republicans were in control, and often they would pass a bill that I didn't like, I didn't think it was in the state's interest, and the House would kill it. And I thank God there was a House. And as governor, again and again, I saw the wisdom of having two houses, where I would sponsor legislation that I thought terrific, and I had observed in the House they would refine it and make it better. It'd go to the Senate, and they would refine it and make it better. I think it's a very, very good, strong system. You know, only Nebraska has a unicameral legislature. I don't know of any political experts in the country who spend their summers in Nebraska studying their wonderful system. The fact is, where do they come to study how a state government should work? Often they come to Minnesota because we have a good system. It works well. It is a little messy. At the end of the session, conference committees do have great power, not as much as they used to because reforms have been made, in part thanks to the leadership of Jean Merriam. When I was there in a conference committee, you could insert language that wasn't in either bill, and a valid criticism. Today, that's not permitted. Today, legislators can know what's in a conference committee report. If they don't like what's in there, they can send it back to the conference committee.
Mm-hmm. Senator Merriam, if the system is working well, or if we're seen as having a good legislative process, why mess around with it? Nebraska is the only state that's gone this way. 13 other states have thought about moving to a unicameral system and have rejected the idea. Why not stick with what we've got?
Gary, just because what we have works doesn't mean it can't be improved. The degree to which it works, I guess we could argue about, but I'm convinced that if we could have every citizen of the state watch the last 3 weeks of a legislative session, we'd get dramatic change. Whether it be unicameral or not, I'm not sure. I think it would be, but I think we'd get dramatic change. You know, we brought in the legislature back a little over a decade ago, and working with the Humphrey Institute at the University of Minnesota, brought in a group of academicians to look at the Minnesota legislature. And they spent a couple of years doing that, looking at in depth what works. And they published their study in a book called Tribune of the People. And they recommended that the state go to a unicameral system. They said the current system has enough flaws in it that we ought to look at going at a unicameral system. And let me just read you a short tribute to that book by a prominent Minnesotan. I know of no other book which looks at the institution of the state legislature in such depth and with such sensitivity as to how the process really works. Tribune of the People is a wealth of information and a suitable agenda for debating the fundamental issues. That was by the very prominent former Governor Wendell Anderson that's quoted on the cover of that book. So I think if you read what the academicians say and their conclusions after studying it, if you listen to a number of legislators who have joined us on the Minnesotans for a single house legislature, I think we've made the case for getting the discussion on the ballot and to the electorate.
Let me respond. First of all, it was a good book. And I obviously didn't subscribe to everything, but I'm not afraid to look at the issue of unicameral. But let me just tell you what George Washington's attitude was toward the issue. You know, Thomas Jefferson wanted a unicameral legislature. George Washington, bicameral. There's visiting together, and Thomas Jefferson started drinking some coffee, and as he put the coffee to his lips, of course, it burned his lips. So he took the coffee and put it into a saucer. And George Washington said to Thomas, he said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, the coffee was so hot, I put it in a saucer to cool it." And George Washington said, "Yes, that's why we need a two-house legislature, because there's some political issues so hot that the body politic can't deal with it in the short term. You want to let it cool, and that's why you need a two-house legislature, and that's really why you needed a Senate." I think George Washington was right. I think if he were here today, he'd tell Gene, "Gene, you're wrong." And I think if Thomas Jefferson were here, he'd say, "Gene, I was wrong."
We're talking this hour about whether Minnesota should move to a unicameral legislative. The debate is officially underway now at the state capitol. We should note, by the way, that on Friday there's going to be a public hearing at the Capitol. There's another legislative hearing tomorrow, public hearing on Friday, and it's conceivable that at least one of the House committees could vote on this even Friday afternoon yet. Joining us here in the studio, Jean Merriam, who is co-chair of the Citizens Committee for a Single House Legislature. Mr. Merriam served in the state Senate for over 20 years, right?
22 years.
And former Minnesota Governor Wendell Anderson has joined us. He's on the steering committee of opponents of a unicameral House. Governor Anderson, besides being a former governor, served in both the Minnesota House and the state Senate. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828.
Gene mentioned earlier that if people watched the session the last three, 4 weeks, they'd be turned off. Of course, it reminds me of the comment that you shouldn't watch either laws or sausage being made. But I would differ with you, Gene. I think the last three, 4 weeks, when the legislature is winding down and putting all these things together, I think the voters would be impressed as to how knowledgeable legislators are, how hard they work. And frankly, the end result, I think, is often outstanding, surprisingly good. It's a difficult process. But I think one of the reasons that Gene is for the unicameral legislature is, about 10 years ago, he and I were fishing on Lake Superior, and it was perfectly calm, and he got seasick. He has a stomach that can't stand, bounces up and down, so he would like to have a unicameral legislature that's smooth and not controversial and no committees. That way he won't get seasick.
Let me, I wanted to get to some callers here, but Senator Merriam, I do need to ask you this before we start with our callers here. Isn't much of what happens at the end of a legislative session, which can be pretty untidy, isn't that much of that the result of human nature, that people just put off these decisions till the very end? And wouldn't that occur in a unicameral system, too, where, you know, legislators would have hearings and they'd diddle-doddle around for several months, and then it gets to be a couple of days before adjournment, and whoops, we got to do something here.
Yeah, to be sure that it's kind of human nature to put off decisions until you have to make them. But the problem with doing that in a bicameral system with those conference committees, first of all, place a great deal of the ultimate power of the legislature in the relatively few members that serve on a particular conference committee. In addition, you spend much of your time posturing and positioning, not what you want to have formulated as public policy, but to stake out your negotiating position for those conference committees. So as a result, when those conference committees come back in the last few days of a legislative session, there isn't time to digest it, to even read the bills, let alone to have good discussion about what's in them.
Is there any way that the legislature, short of passing a unicameral proposal, could they modify the way they operate give members more time to work through the conference committee reports, or perhaps change the chair of the conference? Is there any kind of internal reforms that they could do short of this constitutional change?
Yes, there are, Gary. But as Senator Speer has stated in his comments, that after 28 years, he's convinced that the bicameral system is beyond reform. There are a lot of interesting suggestions that have been proposed, including there are some places that are bicameral without using conference committees. They simply amend bills and pass them back and forth between the two houses until they come to agreement.
Let me just comment. First of all, Gene, you know, in Nebraska, with the unicameral system, what have they passed there that's so wonderful that we don't have here? I mean, what bad legislation have they killed that we haven't been able to kill? I mean, the burden is on you folks to come up and demonstrate this system that apparently is so wonderful. I'm not aware of anybody bragging about Nebraska what they're able to do with the unicameral system. When Gene says that those people that serve in committees have more power and authority, he's absolutely right. He was one of those people that had that kind of power and authority. Why? First of all, because his colleagues trusted him. A little bit of it came from seniority, but most from integrity and character and knowledge. And I think in the legislature, with everything, you have to delegate. You can't be an expert in every field. And at the end of the session, there is not time to study every single bill in every single committee if you're in a position of responsibility as Gene was. But again, that's part of the legislative process. It's part of business. It's part of Congress. And our system works.
Let me, you know, very brief. I do want to get to some callers here, but quick comment.
I really resist the notion, and it comes up all the time, that Nebraska becomes the argument. Why don't we talk about Mississippi or Alabama, which are bicameral, and nobody wants to emulate them? Let me suggest this, that we have a bicameral system because of historical evolutionary accident more than any other reason. It's a throwback to having the House of Lords where the democracy was not to be entirely entrusted to the general electorate. And we've stuck with that system as we've evolved. Think about this, and what other institution of human endeavor do we have two governing boards? What's radical is that the 49 states stick with the bicameral system.
Well, if I can comment on what he said. The reason we look at Nebraska, it's the only state that has unicameral. The reason we don't look to Mississippi or Alabama, they're not trying to change Mississippi or Alabama structure. You're trying to change Minnesota, where we have a terrific system.
Mark, your question, please.
I think that what I'm listening to is just politics at its greatest. It's the art of diversion, and all we have to do is keep changing the topic and keep putting people's focus in different areas. One argument right now is, why are we focusing on Nebraska? And I put it to you that the reason that Nebraska even came in is when the governor, whose background may not be pleasing to the status quo, when he suggested a unicameral legislation, everyone thought he was nuts until he finally came up and said, well, Nebraska's good. And then all of a sudden, the state started thinking, oh, wow, well, I guess this isn't something just off the cuff. It could be something valid. And then contrary to what Governor Anderson was saying about how great this works his example of that it goes from one place, and thank God it passed in the House and didn't pass in the Senate, and vice versa. That is exactly the argument for a unicameral legislation. That is exactly the point that the governor's making, and that a lot of Minnesotans are interested in hearing and debating. Okay. And I would say the reason for that is there is cynicism. There's a lot of cynicism out here. And, you know, if you're up for election, you are going to vote yes on the issues that are important to the people. And if you're in the other house and you're not up for election, well, it's okay, because you'll get another shot to vote in the direction that the people really want before your next election comes up.
Okay.
And that is exactly
All right.
what our point is.
Thanks, Mark. Do legislators use the existence of the other house for political advantage? That is to say, do they take votes that they no, aren't going to go anywhere, but in favor of a bill or oppose a bill, and just to get something on the record because they know it's going to die in the other chamber?
Sure. That happens not infrequently.
Is that bad?
First, let me say I don't think that's really bad, and of course it could happen under a unicameral legislature. I think the caller did not understand my point, and maybe I made it poorly, but the point I was trying to make is that often if one body or the other passes legislation that I think is not in the state's interest, it's not something that was passed for political purposes. It was something that House believed in, but I think was a mistake. The other point I would make is often the public is not even alerted to the fact that there's legislation pending until it passes one House, and they hear about it on public radio or they read about it in the paper, and then they generate a public outcry and testify on it and will mount a campaign against it or for it, depending on what their view might be.
Mm-hmm. Would it be, we have to take a break here, but quick on this, would it be easier to pass laws in a unicameral system? That is, one of the arguments that we hear is that it might be easier to get legislation through
Let me respond first. If, in fact, you have a bill that you believed in and you went to the committee chair and you had a one-house system and that person was opposed to it, it's over with. You can't get a hearing. If you have a two-house legislature, you can go to the chair of that comparable committee in the other body, get it introduced, get a hearing on it, maybe get it through that body, and generate some public support.
Senator Merriam?
I don't believe it would be the thing to get a easiest way to get a bill passed is to understand who's going to be on the conference committee and deal with the relative members of a conference committee. You talk about when the public isn't aware. Countless times, not even legislators are aware of until something's passed, until after the session, because it was a small provision in a great big omnibus appropriations bill coming out of a conference committee.
We're talking this hour about whether Minnesota should move to a unicameral legislative system. The debate is now officially underway at the state capitol. Joining us here in the studio to talk about the pros and cons of unicameralism, Senator Jean Merriam, co-chair of the Citizens Committee for a single-house legislature. Former Minnesota Governor Wendell Anderson is here. He is on the steering committee of opponents of a unicameral house. Again, if you'd like to join our conversation, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. More callers in a couple of minutes.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by Flaherty & Associates, a professional association representing government and business on state public policy issues.
Enjoy the treasures of Europe this spring with Minnesota Public Radio's Magic of Music Tour of Italy, April 27th through the 7th of May. This 9-day trip includes Milan and Venice with fabulous concerts, including baritone Thomas Hampson with the Orchestra of Florence. The package also includes airfare, lodging at 4- and 5-star Italian hotels, meals, and more. For information and reservations, call 1-800-228-7123 or check out our website at mpr.org.
Hope you can join us over the noon hour today. We're going to be talking with Congressman Bruce Vento. He'll be joining us. Congressman Vento, of course, announced last week that he will not be seeking re-election. He spent 24 years in the Congress, but he's been diagnosed now with cancer, and he's going to spend this year dealing with that problem. He's going to come by today, an hour, to talk about his career in Congress, so hope you can join us. Right now, news headlines. Here's Marianne Sullivan. Marianne.
Thank you, Gary. In the news this hour, the hijackers of the Afghan airliner have released another hostage. It's the 9th person freed since the plane landed outside London on Sunday. Police say the hijackers may want asylum. It's been a good day on Wall Street so far. After a report showing workers' productivity surged at the close of last year, the Dow has been up by about 100 points for most of the day so far. Magician Doug Henning has died after a battle with liver cancer. He was 52. Henning helped revive the popularity of magic as mass entertainment with his 1970s rock musical The Magic Show on Broadway. Governor Jesse Ventura says he doesn't want his proposal for a one-house state legislature to become bogged down in politics. Ventura and key lawmakers revealed their proposal for a single 135-member body to a legislative committee last night. If legislators approve the measure, the question will go before voters next November for ratification. Ventura says he doesn't want putting the unicameralism question on the ballot to become tangled up with issues such as taxes and bonding. The bill remains a long shot, particularly without the support of the Senate DFL majority. The FBI office in Minneapolis has started a website to fight crime in Minnesota and the Dakotas. The site offers information about the office and asks for the public's help in solving several cases, including the 1998 killing of Julianne Holmquist near Halleck in northwestern Minnesota and the 1998 fatal shooting of a Brinks employee during a holdup at a Target store in Bloomington. The John Bear Grease Sled Dog Marathon has been shortened again due to poor trail conditions. Warm weather has forced Bear Grease officials to shorten the race 13 miles by moving the finish line from Grand Marais to the Devil's Track checkpoint. Race Marshal Jack Welsh blames mild weather for an extremely icy and hazardous trail into Grand Marais. Defending Bear Grease champion John Barron lost a dog but was still the first musher into the Poplar Lake checkpoint this morning. One of Barron's dogs hurt her shoulder slipping on an icy path. Across Minnesota today, a few clouds in the north with a chance of snow. Breezy and partly cloudy in the south, reaching for a high near 50 in southwestern Minnesota. That's the latest from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Marianne Sullivan.
Thanks, Marianne. It's 24 minutes before noon. This is midday on Minnesota Public Radio. We've been joined here in the studio by former Minnesota Governor Wendell Anderson and former State Senator Jean Merriam. They are on opposite sides of the unicameral issue, whether Minnesota go to a one-house legislature. There's a proposal at the legislature to put that issue on the ballot this fall. It require a change in Minnesota's constitution, and supporters want to put it on the ballot and let them vote on whether or not we should scrap the traditional two-house legislature and move to a single-house legislature. Lots of callers on the line. If you'd like to join them with your question, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. David, go ahead, please.
Well, you know, there is no perfect system, and both Senator Merriam and Governor Anderson have made good points. I don't think there's any question that the major flaw in the present system is the conference committee. On the other hand, with the unicameral body, how do you prevent things from going through too quickly for people to realize what's happened? We do have plenty of examples of unicameral legislative bodies here in the state, namely city councils and county boards. And to give one example, in Minneapolis, I think it's a bad example. I called my counter's attention to the fact that they don't even use a recognizable parliamentary procedure by bringing up a proposal in the main body and then sending it to committee so everyone knows what's going on. And the answer was, well, that's inefficient. Let's take a look at the other alternatives, like the Swedish system, and see if there is some way to improve the bicameral system instead of just simply wiping it out altogether.
Okay. Well, I know Representative McElroy has suggested that maybe the answer here is not to go to a one-house system, but to modify what the Senate does and change that change it in that way. Would that be a better alternative?
I think that actually Representative McElroy has some several different proposals, and I think they reflect Representative McElroy's thoughtful and serious consideration of addressing the problem. And I think he has some good ideas. One of them is to have more joint committees, more joint work done at the beginning of the session, so you're not dealing with all the joint consideration late in the session. He's got the proposals that you can amend the bill more than once as they go back and forth between the two houses. And I think that they do have some merit.
Mm-hmm. Vern, former legislator Vern Sommerdorf is on the line now. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, as a former legislator,
is this Dr. Sommerdorf?
I just wanted to make two points. I'm not in favor of the unicameral system. I think our present system is working fairly well. When I was in the legislature, I found that there were people who had knowledge on certain things that I didn't have, and I could rely sometimes on the information I needed the proper decision. Also working on a number of conference committees, I didn't find the abuses that are frequently mentioned. For instance, in one case, our committee had recognized a problem, and we'd spent a lot of time studying that problem. We'd gone to other parts of the state, even to Kansas, to study this. And so when we came to conference, our bill was considerably different than the Senate's. Mm-hmm. And because we had quite a bit of knowledge, many of our points were accepted in the final bill. However, we've also found that the senators were half again as old as we were and been around the legislature three or four times as long as we had. And they had some points that they could make and show us that some of our ideas weren't the best. So I think that the bill that finally came out of our conference committee and was passed by the House and Senate and signed by the governor was better than either bill when it first passed their respective bodies.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
I think he made a better argument than I have why we should keep the bicameral system. That's former State Representative Vern Sommerdorf, medical doctor, known in medical circles for having delivered the three children that I have. And he did a good job there as well. But he makes a very, very good point, and it reminds me, again, that Gene did not serve in the House, and the House is a far different legislative body than the Senate. On the House side, frankly, you're in session two or three times more than the Senate. It's normally people with less experience. It's a more wide-open system. On the Senate side, it's more people. They tend to be older. Most of them come there with a different background than House people, but it's a healthy mix. But they are diverse and different, and it's wonderful to have both.
But, Governor, it is true, or it seems to be true to an outsider, that at the end of these sessions, you always hear, after the session is over, everybody's gone home, and there's always head-scratching. You always hear about head-scratching. Well, I didn't know that was in the bill. I wouldn't have voted for it.
Of course, that happens on a unicameral system as well. You have large bills late in the session. That's part of the process. But I think it's very rare that somebody reads about a bill that is not in the state's interest, something that's bad. They might see something in there that they didn't know about. But most of the ills that Gene refers to have been taken care of. When I was there, you could insert new language into a conference committee. You can't do that anymore. So it's a red herring to be complaining about a conference committee where someone can insert language that wasn't in either bill. That's not the case anymore.
Senator Merriam, wouldn't you lose a good sense of the diversity of opinion that you currently have at the legislature if you moved to that one House legislature, what Representative Sommerdorf was talking about, what the governor is referring to, the older folks, perhaps, and wouldn't you narrow the range of opinion on given issues?
Well, I suppose that any time you reduce the number of decision makers, and what we're talking about is reducing the current 201 combined House and Senate legislature to 135 unicameral legislature, you would have. You would have less diversity, I suppose, and range of opinions. And there are some trade-offs involved. And let me be the first to stipulate that unicameral is not a panacea. And I've been on many, many conference committees in my 22-year career that worked kind of like in a textbook fashion, where the final product was better than either that came to the conference committee. But I've been on some many, many conference committees where it didn't work very well, and have seen many, many conference committees where it didn't very well. And in my considered opinion, after those 22 years of experience, I think we'd be better off without them.
Stephen, your question, please.
Well, I lived in Nebraska for 3 years, and so I had and have lived in Minnesota 15, and I've got some opinions, I guess, pro and con for unicameral. Living in Nebraska, it served Nebraska very well. It's a larger rural state. They're not very politically in tune. Government's a necessary evil. They get it over with quick, and it's efficient. On the other hand, it was easy to block legislation down there. It's was easier for a special interest, I think, to dominate the legislature. And I think in Minnesota, where it's more liberally oriented, that I think I'd be in favor of longer bicameral sessions because there are more issues and it's more controversial in Minnesota.
Okay. Well, he raises the point about lobbyists. Now, this is something that comes up. Would it be easier for lobbyists to influence a unicameral system or the existing bicameral system?
Well, of course, he just said he lived in Nebraska, and he said there special interests tended to dominate the legislature there. I hope I didn't misquote him, but isn't that what he said?
Right.
I think he's right.
Senator Merriam?
Well, I don't agree. Let me just put it first in some historical context. Nebraska didn't start with a unicameral legislature. The famous prairie populist U.S. Senator George Norris. That's a Freudian slip. I'll get back to that. George Norris led that fight, and one of the evils he was going after in his populist movement was to diminish the power of the lobbyists. Let me portray it this way. I haven't been in the legislature. I've been gone now for 4 years. But I'll bet you if in the next 10 minutes, if I were challenged, I could come up with the majority of the members who are going to be the majority of the members in April of the important conference committees in the Minnesota legislature. And I'll bet you that the people whose job it is to convince those legislators of the virtue of their special interest, the lobbyists, know that much better than I. So I think that the nature of the bicameral systems and the concentrated power of the conference committees lends itself much more to a special interest influence than a unicameral system.
Well, of course, they, Gene, we just said, or you're talking about reducing the number of legislators from 201 to 135. It's obviously easier to keep track of one house and a body of 135 than two houses and 201. It's easier for a special interest group to get control of one body rather than two. I mean, I think you can't refute that. I think it's safer to have a two-house legislature. You might argue that it's not as efficient, that it's more expensive, and I'll accept that. But it's obviously much more difficult to take control of a two-house legislature.
Is it easier for the average citizen, then, to track what happens in a one-house legislature versus a two-house legislature?
I tell you why. Just what I mentioned earlier. Often a member of the public doesn't even know a bill has been introduced until it passes one house or the other, and they hear about it on public radio or they read about it, and that's when they become concerned and interested.
Well, two issues there that let me jump in on. One is, sure, openness is one of the things that the governor spoke to in at the beginning of the show, and I believe that there's no question that it would be easier for the citizen to follow what's going on and influence his or her elected representatives. Influence. The point you made, Wendy, is that it's irrefutable that with one house you would have...
My point is, obviously, it's easier to control one body than two.
I think so, because you'd have decentralized power in the one body.
I don't accept that. In the unicameral legislature throughout the world... And one of the callers mentioned it's easier if you have one speaker to deal with rather than a speaker on the House side and a majority leader in the state. Just look at Minnesota. You have to deal with a Norwegian speaker of the House and a Norwegian state senator, two different personalities. That's tougher to control than having one or the other. I mean, may I ask you this? Who's going to be the speaker of this one-house legislature? Is it going to be Roger Moe? Or is it going to be the current speaker? And as I say, whoever holds that position, we know who it is, and it's easier to have influence over one than two.
But the person's position becomes less significant.
The power of
the speaker comes primarily from his ability to pull his or her members by their appointments.
Of course.
To conference committees.
Of course, but now you have one...
Where the decisions are going to be made.
No, you have one person appointing people, and that's where the power comes. Who's going to be the chair of the committee and what people serve on that committee. But if you have two houses, you dilute the power of the speaker. It provides an extra option for the citizens, those interested in government.
Well, let's get to a caller on here before we wrap up. Stan, quick question?
I have a quick question. I'm interested in the self-interest of these two debaters to see what interest they may have in the outcome. If Mr. Merriam works for any kind of a special interest at all that cares about the outcome of this, is as registered as a lobbyist, or if Mr. Anderson
look,
is registered lobbyist.
He's directing that question. Am I registered as a lobbyist? Yes, I am. But I have every right to speak, and I resent this inquiry.
Governor Ventura has argued that really the pros and cons of this issue are almost irrelevant at this point. That what the legislature needs to decide, first of all, is whether to put it on the ballot. Governor Ventura cites the fact that, according to the polls, 70% of the people say they want to vote on this. Now, both of you gentlemen have been involved in the process. Is that something the legislature should just clear the way on? The governor points out that the legislators themselves have a conflict of interest here, and they ought to just put the ballot and let the people decide. Is that reasonable?
Well, I certainly think it's reasonable for the governor to take that position, and I would look forward to having these discussions with Wendy over the next 9 months till Election Day till we resolve the issue.
Let me just respond. First of all, legislators don't have a conflict any more than the governor has a conflict. When he signs a State Department bill that finances the governor's operation, his safety, and provides for a pay increase, I mean, that's just part of the process. The only polls I've seen show that 51% of the people polled are against a unicameral legislature. And let me just say this. You know, both President Bush and President Truman quote on the wall when they're president by Edmund Burke, which said this: a representative owes the people not only his industry but his judgment, and he betrays them if he sacrifices it to their opinion. I don't believe in initiative and referendum. That's what you have in California. I think it's a mess. They put many, many things on the ballot, ends up in the courts. I think that's chaos. We've got a good system. Let's keep it.
How do you folks see this playing out? I mean, the conventional wisdom is that it will zip house and then may or may not pass the Senate. Senator Miriam?
I think that your conventional wisdom is as good as mine, Gary. That there's stronger support for it in the House than in the Senate. And what I expect is that sometime, what I hope, is that sometime near the end of February that the bill is passed off the House floor and over to the Senate, where it will be in play for the last month of the legislative session.
Mm-hmm. Governor Anderson?
I think it's dead. I think the bill is dead.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fun to debate it and talk about it.
Okay.
I think we're ready to move on to other issues.
All right. And one other question before we wrap up. Are either one of you gentlemen surprised that the governor has made this his top priority? It seems a little esoteric of all the things that a governor could select as an issue.
I've been pleasantly surprised, and I had some discussions, I've had several discussions with the governor and his staff about this, and understanding, ask Dean Barkley, probably the founder and leader of the Reform Party in Minnesota, how the Reform Party, unlike the Democrats and Republicans, came to support this. He said, we were over a few years ago touting campaign reform. And we saw how this process worked and became convinced that we needed a unicameral system.
Gentlemen, thanks for coming in today. I really appreciate it. Former State Senator Gene Miriam, who is chair of the Citizens Committee for a single House legislature, and former Minnesota Governor Wendell Anderson, he's on the steering committee of opponents of a unicameral House, stopping by today to talk about the unicameral debate that's underway at the state capitol. A couple of reminders. Again, there's a public hearing at the capitol on this issue Friday morning. Also, check out our website, r.org, and you'll find all kinds of information on this issue and all the other issues that are surfacing at the state capitol.
If you've been an NPR listener for a while, you've probably noticed that our membership drives have been getting shorter and shorter. And this month, we're trying something new. On Wednesday, February 9th, we're having an online membership drive. Instead of taking time on air, we'll be asking you to become a member online. When you do, you'll not only be supporting the programming you love, you'll also help reduce the actual number of hours in our on-air membership drive. So join us, Web Wednesday, February 9th, online at npr.org.
Now that's tomorrow, so get your fingers ready to go and make sure you log in. You might even win a new Volkswagen Beetle, I'm told. That's tomorrow, Web Wednesday, here on Minnesota Public Radio.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 8th of February, 2000. It's the birthday of Robert Burton, 1577, Lindley, England, the author of The Anatomy of Melancholy, published in 1621. Burton himself suffered from melancholia and compiled all that was known about the condition, all of its causes, and other information on human behavior. It was on this day in 1587 that Mary, Queen of Scots, was beheaded at Fia Castle in Northumber, England, on the orders of Queen Elizabeth I. Mary had been involved in a number of plots to assassinate Elizabeth, and the public demanded that she be put on trial for treason. It was on this day in 1883 an insurance salesman in New York by the name of Lewis Waterman started his experiments to create the first workable fountain pen. He created a pen nib with tiny grooves that allowed air in while the ink was flowing out. The fountain pen was a writing instrument until the ballpoint pen came along in the late 1940s. And it's the birthday in 1906 in Seattle of the man who invented the Xerox, Chester F. Carlson,
1938 at his laboratory in Queens, developed electrophotography, a technique by which an image is created on a electrically charged plate, powdered ink is put on the image, and then fused to paper with heat. The first commercial model came on the market in 1950. And today is the birthday of the poet Elizabeth Bishop, born 1911 in Worcester, Massachusetts. Grew up with various relatives in Nova Scotia, Boston, and as an adult, lived in Florida and Mexico, and for many years in Brazil. She wrote few poems, published only about 80 poems in her lifetime. Her first book, North and South, came out in 1946, and a revised edition 10 years later won a Pulitzer Prize. Here's a poem by Elizabeth Bishop on her birthday, entitled For CWB. Let us live in a lull of the long winter winds, where the shy, silver-antlered reindeer go on dainty hoofs with their white rabbit friends amidst the delicate flowering snow. All of our thoughts will be fairer than doves. We will live upon wedding cake frosted with sleet. We will build us a house from two red cloths and wear scarlet mittens on both hands and feet. Let us live in the land of the whispering trees, alder and aspen and poplar and birch, singing our prayers in a pale sea-green breeze with starflower rosaries and moss banks for church. All of our dreams will be clearer than glass, clad in the water or sun as you wish. We will watch the white feet of the young morning pass and dine upon honey and small shiny fish. Let us live where the twilight lives after the dark. In the deep, drowsy blue, let us make us a home. Let us meet in the cool evening grass with a stork and a whistle of willow played by a gnome. Half asleep, half awake, we shall hear, we shall know, the soft miserere the wood swallow tolls. We will wander away where wild raspberries grow and eat them for tea from two lily-white bowls. A poem from 1929 by Elizabeth Bishop, entitled For CWB, from the Complete Poems, 1927 to 1979. Published by Noonday Press of Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, February 8th, made possible by the people at 21 North Main, sellers of used, rare, and out-of-print books, and supporters of national literacy campaigns. Technical direction by Scott Rivar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Regional broadcasts of the Writer's Almanac are supported by Marquette Banks, your community bank, offering a broad range of financial services for your business and personal needs.
News headlines are next, and then right after the news, we're going to be talking with Congressman Bruce Vento.
Mark your calendar for the Sound Money Personal Finance Fair coming February 11th and 12th. There'll be seminars on IRAs, hot stocks, and lots more. Tickets available now online at soundmoney.org or call 1-800-228-7123.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. We have a partly cloudy sky, 29 degrees at KNRW FM, 91.1.